What do they know about the United States? How much is there anything on television? Is the Gong Show on TV in Russia? What is there any envy over those Americans who can go buy anything they want? Tell us about that.
You know, not anymore, because economic conditions improved enough in the last couple of decades that Russians saw a really material change in their buying power and their earning power and in their shopping power. There's lots of chain restaurants in cities throughout Russia. There's lots of foreign grocery chains. There's a French chain that's very successful. So the material goods were, until the recent economic problems, the sources of material goods were really improved. It was completely un-Soviet. So they did really feel themselves to be becoming part of Europe or becoming part of the sort of international community. Russians know about foreign material goods, and they feel they have access to them, except now, of course, the economic problems are so dire that people are forced to return to using mostly locally made products. But they don't envy the political systems either of Europe or the United States. People in Russia like to vote because throughout Soviet times, they voted, and they voted a lot. But their votes were all basically ways of ratifying whatever the ruling regime had decided. You know, so Russians do feel that their vote somehow counts. It shows that, yes, we agree with this. Yes, we support Mr. Putin. Yes, we support our local parliamentary candidates. But democracy, such as as we know in the United States, is a very foreign thing to them. Opposition candidates do not campaign successfully in Putin's Russia. They're shut down whenever they make an appearance. So, and the government tends to support this and to teach people that political opposition is treasonous. It goes against Russian unity. It's helping the enemy. It's the product of foreign interference. All these things make it unpalatable for Russians to accept a Western-style political system.
Is there any interface between NGOs, international visitors coming in and going? Do they have freedom to wander around and go almost anywhere they want, both American and European?
That's interesting. That was the case when I got there, that Amnesty International, Transparency International, all these, USAID was operating in Russia. And it was supporting a lot of these civil society groups and election monitoring groups and so forth. This, by the way, is what Mr. Putin thinks of as American meddling in Russian politics, especially election monitoring. We don't want that. And that's a kind of a whataboutist thing that you often hear from Russian officials. Did they meddle in our election? Well, the Americans have been meddling in our politics for years. You know, they set up all these civil society groups that attack the government. You know, that's what Putin sees as the American hand in his politics, and that's what he deeply resents about the United States. So in the 4 years that I was there, most of these groups were shut down. The foreign groups, you know, like Amnesty International, have been thrown out. Groups that were supported by American money, by USAID money, or by European institutes, you know, German and Scandinavian civil society groups, they've all been labeled as foreign agents. And as I'm sure you've heard, to the Russian mind, the word foreign agent from Soviet times was always synonymous with traitor. So You know, the groups that still exist have lost an enormous amount of power and influence. And I would say that Putin has been very successful in sort of destroying the NGO community.
Syria. Is this part of Putin's Mother Russia return, the grand power? What's he doing in Syria? What's he doing in areas that Russians don't usually meddle?
Actually, yeah. The Syria gambit was a really, I think, daring tactic on Putin's part. By sending Russian troops and planes to Syria to support Bashar al-Assad, he was really sticking his neck out. The Russian people weren't very interested in that conflict. It went against something that the Russian government has used as a sort of straw man for years, that is to say, Islamist terrorism. Russia, as you know, has a very big Muslim population. And so there's a real fear about Islamist terrorism leaking over from these conflicts that began with the Arab Spring and turned into the Syrian civil war. So Russians did not have very much appetite for this adventure at the start, and it took a really big PR effort to convince Russians that they actually supported this. It goes back to the Afghan war. You know, Russians were very disaffected after the participation in the Afghan war. They lost a lot of people. They lost, you know, a lot of treasure, and they got absolutely nothing for it. So Russians were suspicious when Putin went into Syria. But he very soon convinced them, I think, that not only was this something that redounded to the glory of Russia, one of the things he said was it was protecting Russian lives. He said, we want to wipe them out, you know, on their own territory before they come here. And that resonated with people. So, and plus the constant coverage of heroic Russian fighter pilots flying over Syrian skies and that kind of thing. Well, you know, on this end of things, we were hearing that Russian and Syrian army troops were committing war crimes. They were using chemical weapons. They were using white phosphorus. They were bombing civilian areas in rebel-held regions. You know, none of that, of course, was heard in the Russian media. So it, at the very beginning, it was a successful gamble, and that's the time when the Russian government was predicting first that this would only last about 3 months before we withdraw. Later, well, this would take about 9 months. Now, of course, it's completely open-ended, and although the Putin regime has proclaimed victory, there's not a lot. I don't see light at the end of their tunnel. I think they're deeply invested in a very costly adventure for them. And I don't see, if they keep Bashar al-Assad in power, I don't see how they get out of there.
China. Tell us, are they getting along with Chinese? Are they collaborating? Are they belligerent allies? Tell me, what can we foresee a China-Russia coalition? Is there one somewhere?
I think there might be coalitions of convenience. But I don't think there is a natural affinity between Russia and China. China sees Russia as being a weak partner, economically weak, even militarily not that strong, and also not that predictable. You know, I mean, the Chinese leadership likes things to be stable and predictable, and they worry about the situation in Russia. From Russia's point of view, about 3 years ago, Putin proclaimed a pivot to Asia. He was no longer going to be associated with Europe. This was after the sanctions came in. So there were good reasons why Russia should turn its back on Europe and turn to do business with Asia. And as you may remember, they did a lot of big deals with the Chinese involving pipelines from central Russia into China and so forth. They were reputedly selling Russian gas at rock bottom prices to the Chinese. None of those deals have ever actually come to pass. Very few of those pipelines have been built, and there's actually very little additional trade between the two countries. China can get its natural gas in a lot safer way from Central Asia, places like Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, where they already have pipelines in place. So there's less in it for China than there is for Russia, and I don't see them forming any natural alliances.
One more. Is there hope for the future?
Not for the near future. I genuinely think that Putin is going to stay in power for the rest of his life. I think were Putin to die, it would cause an enormous amount of instability in Russia, which would be dangerous both for the Russian people and for their neighbors. There's no line of succession. There's no institutional succession in Russia. So, and Putin seems to have decided that his options for dealing with the Trump administration are over for the time being. So no, I don't think there's an opportunity for better relations anytime in the near future.
Well, with that happy note, I'll go back to Caroline.
And I'm going to take the prerogative to ask a question, especially it might be to both of you. What about diplomacy? Today's appointment, is it just smoke and mirrors? Is there no possibility for diplomatic relations at all?
Well, look at the difference between Secretary Tillerson and Secretary Kerry. You know, Secretary Kerry was engaged almost constantly with Russia in one way or another. He was meeting constantly with Lavrov every couple of months. They'd have a big session. They didn't make much progress, but at least they were talking. Tillerson doesn't seem to have had a great deal of contact that we know of with his Russian counterparts. And since he has not filled so many of the important positions, at the upper levels of the State Department, there isn't an institutional framework in there to keep talking about the things that we need to talk about, like nuclear nonproliferation, for instance. So, I don't see much opportunity for diplomacy. And I think the whole thing of the Russians calling for the dismissal of all these employees at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow and their appointment of an openly hostile U.S. ambassador is a sign that they've decided that we're not talking, at least for the foreseeable future.
State Department's been decimated and not being populated. Tom, what are your thoughts about that, well, just based on your experience?
The Russian job has always gone to a Russian insider. They named Governor Huntsman to be the Russian ambassador. He was ambassador in Singapore and then China, so he knows a little bit about the business. My point is he a Russian expert? You better get somebody who knows what he's talking about, as Corey has just said. Plus, this vacancy business at the State Department. I was talking to somebody on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee a couple of weeks ago. They're trying to get a hearing on Europe, and they can't find an assistant secretary. They haven't been appointed yet. So that is a big problem. Tillerson can't make all the decisions. And the Russians don't operate in vacuums. Neither does the world. So if they don't start filling some of those positions, we're going to get hurt somewhere. And at least somebody better start looking at that a lot better, Carolyn.
On that happy note, we'll turn it to you all. We have mic runners, so raise your hand right in the middle here. That's going to be tricky to get to, but it's the first one I see right there.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. I loved listening to your reports. I miss you over there. So two questions. One, I'm wondering what the Russian perception is, and Yeah, basically, of Edward Snowden's presence there, and whether you ever got to meet him and talk to him. And my other question is unrelated to that, and that is, what is the word on the street about the British spy's dossier on President Trump, the content of his report? What do you know about that, if anything?
Well, to begin with, about Snowden, you know, the Russians really, and because of the Russian news coverage, Russians really saw Snowden as a sort of fighter for internet privacy rights and for revealing, you know, NSA surveillance and that kind of thing. So that was absolutely their impression of him. I tried to, I requested interviews with Snowden many times through his reporters, through his lawyers, and was never given one. I was inquiring on behalf of the hosts of our major news programs, you know, All Things Considered and Morning Edition, and I said to him, this is your chance, you know, to make your case to the American people about why you chose to do what you did. And we still got no response. And you'll notice that his appearances have been very few and far between. Interviews have been very few and far between. He is become almost a non-entity in Russia now. Nobody sees him. Nobody knows where he is. I mean, he's in Moscow, obviously, but and there's very little prospect that he'll ever find his way home. And I would say that his reputation has diminished over time. I would say that his reputation has diminished over time because of the unorganized way in which he gave over that information and because of the way he clearly had to have cooperated with Russian intelligence.
This is Pepke. Let's
Greenwald's turn, reputation please. Is not so great these days either.
Who's next? Stefan, there's one here. There's one there. There's one there. We're recording. I'd really appreciate it if you would put it on a microphone, please. Then we can have it for posterity. Oh, I'm sorry. We missed that.
I'm sorry. And what was your other question?
Oh, the British. Yeah.
Most people I know, and I am in touch with a lot of my friends and sources in Moscow. None of them took all this stuff very seriously. They, you know, maybe there were some sort of sex tapes or something like that. But you know, Russians are pretty canny about the ability to Photoshop things, and so they don't take these grainy tapes very seriously. I think that anything that might be revealed in the dossier has more to do with business interests than it has to do with anybody's sexual proclivities.
Yep. And Claire, can you come down here? And the gentleman in red will be next. On that side.
I have two questions. I have many more questions, but I'll confine myself to two. First of all, regarding Crimea, the Autonomous Republic of Crimea seceded in an official document. There were 10,000 deaths in the eastern part, and there were only 6 deaths, and it was over in 1 week. And the Crimean considered themselves as having seceded, like Kosovo, and they actually quoted the court of in Europe of accepting Kosovo as being a legitimate secession. That's the first question. Why do we keep calling it an annexation when it was a secession? The second question is, how come, if you've seen the Oliver Stone interviews over 2 years, how come his portrayal and his look is so different from what you have described as being a cold fish?
I don't know what's in Oliver Stone's mind or heart, but I thought that the interview with Putin was embarrassing. I thought that, you know, I don't know how he could have gotten it so wrong in my mind, that he would see Putin as being this hero who's defending Russian interests. You know, the thing that I've learned about Putin during my time in Russia is that he is at heart a gangster, and his regime is a criminal mafia-style regime that's built on very extensive corruption. And he has gone from being an extremely ambitious criminal to being a man who now believes that he does have a sort of God-given mission to restore Russian prestige in the world. And he does believe that he has a legacy that he needs to promote. So he's evolved over time. As to the annexation of Crimea, and it was an annexation, it was not a succession. And the reason I know this, I mean, I've spent a considerable amount of time in Crimea. I was there just before the Russian invasion took place, and I was there shortly afterwards. And a number of things happened that led to that so-called referendum under which Crimeans voted to succeed or to join Russia. One was a demographic change in the nature of Crimea. It is the base for Russia's Black Sea fleet at Sevastopol. And so it has been populated over time by Russian retirees. It's like Norfolk or San Diego. You know, a lot of the population are Russians who liked it so much that they decided to stay there. So there's been a population change. And those people would definitely vote for connection with Russia. That referendum, however, was illegal by any international standard, and it should not be compared with Kosovo in any way. The Kosovo referendum took 9 years to organize, and that was when Kosovo was occupied by UN forces who included Russians. So, you know, that was a vastly different thing. The referendum in Crimea took place within about a week or 10 days after Russian troops had invaded the parliament. They invaded the parliament. They brought in their own group of Russia-friendly legislators who held a secret session and agreed to this referendum. Many Ukrainians in Crimea who didn't want to be any part of this didn't take part in the referendum, such as people from the Crimean Tatar community. And as a result, they produced a result that somehow mimicked a democratic referendum, but it was nothing of the kind. It was a referendum conducted under occupation by Russian military forces, and I would say that by any international standard, it was invalid.
Man in red right there, and then here.
Excuse me. Hi, Michael Garcia. I worked for USIA for a while, and I've seen you up there, Mr. Corlogos. A question I have is when I was working with USIA and working in the Voice of America, and this was during the time when the wall came down, we made some great strides, particularly in Eastern Europe, in terms of getting free media and getting media into it. I guess the question I have, what's happened to our public diplomacy effort? And is the fact that it's no longer independent, as we were with USIA, we're now under the State Department, do you think that's have a positive or a negative effect on our outreach and our ability to change the narrative or at least have an input, substantive input into the narrative in Russia? Thank you.
I think at least as far as Russia is concerned, there was almost nothing that USAID could have done to maintain their position and their support of civil society and journalist, you know, independent journalism and that kind of thing, because the Putin regime was so bent on getting rid of what they saw as American meddling. You know, there's a great deal made in Russia of Victoria Nuland's comment that, hey, we spent $5 billion in Russia and in Ukraine and other parts of Eastern Europe. And that was taken by the Russian media as being a sign that the United States had spent $5 billion in Ukraine trying to undermine the elected government. What, in fact, that money was spent on were things like disposing of nuclear weapons, supporting civil society groups, and so forth. So I think that given the Russian government's determination to make sure that there's no viable opposition, I don't think USAID, under any form of organization, could have done more than they already did.
Also, let me say I was on the USIA board for a number of years, and we had NGOs, we had international visitors, we had libraries out on the street where people could visit, and they cut those down. They united USIA into the State Department. They put them behind fences. Now the common, ordinary citizen around the world can't go to an American library and look up something in National Geographic. So it's a shame what has happened to public diplomacy. And they cut the hell out of the funding for the next one coming up also. VOA is non-existent in Russia, isn't it?
It's virtually non-existent.
It's virtually non-existent. They have one correspondent there who's operating in Moscow right now. They don't do any broadcasting within Russia. They do everything online now.
We have no propaganda ministry in Russia. Russians have correspondents on Russian radio and what's the other one?
And Sputnik and RT.
And you can hear Russian radio in Washington, D.C. And we can't do the same there because of budget cuts and whatever.
Final question.
So I'll try to bring us back to the beginning. The first question, I think, was more or less Putin has given up any idea that he would have some benefit from Trump being president. What do you think Putin had in mind? What was the world as he envisioned it if he had had the result from his investment in trying to get Trump elected and succeeding in that?
I think that the single most important thing as far as relations with the Trump administration, as far as Putin was concerned, would be reducing or eliminating the sanctions that were put in place after the seizure of Crimea and all the subsequent sanctions that have been put on. Particularly the financial sanctions, they have hurt Russia's ability to raise international investment. And it's a really serious curb on the Russian government's activities. So I think that under the best case scenario, as far as Putin was concerned, is that we have friendly relations with the Trump administration. The Trump administration eliminates American sanctions against Russia and convinces our European allies that they should eliminate sanctions as well. I think that's probably true as well. I mean, as I said, Putin at this stage in his life is concerned about his legacy. He would like to have a free hand in foreign relations. He does feel that Russia is disrespected in international forums, that it should be granted the status of a great power, so I think that that's very important. I think that Russian prestige is a very important thing. And the ability to have a free hand in foreign policy around the world.
I want to ask one final question. The elephant in the room is what Mueller's investigation might uncover. If your opinion, what chances do you think there are that anyone in the Trump campaign colluded?
That's a hard one because, you have to define collusion. Did anyone in the Trump campaign contact? Yes, certainly. But the problem is defining who in the campaign. I mean, is it the very highest levels of the campaign? Was that meeting between, Donald Jr. and Jared Kushner and Paul Manafort and the Russian lawyer, was that an indication that the highest levels of the campaign were part of this discussion? And if so, where did that discussion lead? It's very hard to prove that kind of thing. I think that there was certainly contact. As a careful reporter, I would hesitate to say that there was collusion, because I think that won't be known until the investigation is over.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. Let's thank our guests.
You've been listening to Resurgent Russia in the Time of Trump, a special public event hosted by Aspen Public Radio at Pepke Auditorium on August 22, 2017. Corey Flintoff, former NPR bureau chief in Moscow, was joined on stage by Tom Korologos, former U.S. ambassador to Belgium. Thanks for listening.